Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I've been stuck in this lockdown for 6 weeks now.
And my name is Jazza and I have lost all kind of feeling for time. I just feel like this is normality now, which is quite odd. I only get to see and make eye contact and have conversations with two other people. But I'm starting to actually quite like it. How are you dealing with it, Jimmy?
I thought there were three other people in your flat.
Oh, Sienna, who's from South Korea, she has returned to South Korea. So has she flew back?
Yeah, flew back to a government that actually can handle a pandemic.
She has had a lovely time gloating to us over our WhatsApp group, saying how much better her well-being and time is being spent. She was sent a care package by the government welcoming her home. I think we're going to be really lucky if she actually returns to the UK at any point.
Well, you love to hear about it, I think.
Yeah, I know. I resent her. But anyway, not talking about my flatmates anymore. We on this podcast, The Right Dishonourable, touch on politics, social issues and current events weekly at the moment because we have nothing better to do.
That is true. Although that sort of implies that we normally have better things to do, which may or may not be the case. The first topic that we are covering is the news that Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief political advisor, is attending...
Who also ran Vote Leave. He ran the successful campaign to leave the European Union.
We're going to go into his full career history as, he is Satan, allegedly.
I feel like you're blowing out of proportion the media reaction to this just because you like kind of having a go at The Guardian. But anyway, Jimmy, go for it.
I mean... Well, we can get on to that, but Dominic Cummings, whether he is Satan or not, or is seen that way, attended the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, which is one of the two committees. The other one's called NERVTAG. I can't remember what that stands for.
Can I just say, the acronyms are great in UK government, aren't they?
SAGE Cobra, is pretty good. NERVTAG,
Cobra,
I'm not feeling great
SAGE.
About.
I don't know. I think they're above average at the very least.
It's a strong acronym game. But The Guardian reported that he's attending these meetings that are supposed to be impartial scientific advisory meetings and participated in them. And this is bad, apparently, according to other people, it doesn't really matter.
Well, according to some people who were partaking in the SAGE meeting, we don't know who, thought that it was inappropriate that he was present and so active in it. Fine.
Yeah. We are going to be discussing whether we think it's appropriate or not, and as aforementioned, whether Dominic Cummings is Satan himself for
allegedly.
Our first topic.
Why are you so... You cover our asses on absolutely anything, and then as soon... Like, we're throwing around the fact that Dominic Cummings is Satan, left, right and centre. You worry me, Jimmy.
I mean, he's sort of... I don't actually think he's Satan, but he's pretty much unlibelable at this point, I think, just because so many people have chatted so much shit about him that they're not going to pick on, a tiny little podcast like ours.
Your confidence terrifies me.
Indeed. So speaking of people with terrifying confidence, our second topic is going to be about Donald Trump.
So, you know what? I fall into the camp of people who probably would have described Donald Trump's intelligence as actually reasonably high. He comes across as a bumbling... No, not bumbling. That's endearing. A dangerous idiot quite a lot of the time. But actually, at his core, I kind of assumed that he knew what he was doing, that there was some sentience and some calculation going on behind that terrifying orange visage. But this week has just blown all of that out of the water, and I've just had this sudden realization that there is an actual idiot in the White House running the... largest and probably most important country still in the world. And I found that quite terrifying. The thing that pushed me over the edge here and made me realise this was when he was thinking out loud and talked about some findings that a scientific group had found that the coronavirus was didn't last as long on non-permeable surfaces if it was exposed to sunlight, if it were hot, and if it were humid, and also that disinfectant could be used as a way of killing the virus. Donald Trump then took this as a possible cure for someone with coronavirus, suggesting that people should go outside so that the virus got hit by light, and seeing if there could be a way of being able to put this light inside the body, and then saying the same thing about injections, the possibility of injecting cleaning liquid into people, which, to be very clear, is incredibly dangerous and would probably kill you. He's since backtracked on that and said that he was being sarcastic and tricking the media, and has now said that he's no longer going to be doing daily press briefings. This is mainly a chance, I assume, for you as well, Jimmy, to kind of scream into the void. I'm guessing I'm going to be doing the screaming, you're going to be rational.
I think I'm going to be doing the laughing. I think the story is utterly hilarious. It's of all the incredibly ridiculous, dumbass things that he said over the course of the however long he's been running for president or acting as president, this is definitely top five territory, I think.
I think this is objectively the most stupid thing that he has ever said. It's not just a stupid thing. Like, intelligent people can say stupid thing. See the 150 plus back catalogue of this podcast.
Very flattering to both of us, I think.
Thank you. I'm mainly talking about you, actually, to be completely honest. Because I only say intelligent things. Only an idiot could say this and think this.
I think we should leave it to the actual topic, but it is it's certainly a statement that somebody has said. We can leave it at that for the time being.
You're keen to start to talk about Dominic Cummings being Satan, but you won't call the President of the United States an idiot. I call cowardice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very cowardly in the face of Donald Trump, the Trumpster, the Donald.
Oh, stop.
Speaking of things that people have said, we're actually going to be pandering to Jazz's, one of Jazz's favourite topics, not Eurovision this time. We're going to be talking about...
It's the other one, the other obsession I have.
But RuPaul's Drag Race, which is a show about drag queens that Jazza has mentioned once or twice on our great podcast.
It's still the most successful thing that we've ever made is still about RuPaul's Drag Race. If you don't know what we're talking about, dear listener, I got Jimmy and a friend of the podcast, John, to be two straight guys who react to watching Drag Race for the first time about 3 years ago, and it's sitting on 100,000 views or something like that on the internet.
113,000.
Oh, excellent! I'm glad you checked.
Yeah. I've never been insulted by so many so many LGBT people in one sitting.
In one sitting. In one you sitting. Get it from me every week, but it's never been so voluminous, you know?
It's, the frequency and, centrality as well. And that's probably not the right word, but it was concentrated, I think it's fair to say. Anyway, more recently on RuPaul's Drag Race, Jeff Goldblum, the actor, was invited to participate as a guest judge for one of the end sections. So I assume
it's episode 9 of season 12, if there you want to catch up on Netflix.
And in response to one particular drag queen called Jackie Cox, who had sort of reflected her own Iranian heritage in her costume, I guess we could call it that.
Her look. We'll call it a look.
Go have a look. She was wearing a stars and stripes like headscarf and dress, basically. And she went on this rant's probably a harsh word. Went on this speech about like Trump's anti-Muslim ban and how that had made her feel, given that her own heritage. And Jeff Goldblum, in response to that, said, "Is there something in this religion, referring to Islam, that is anti-homosexuality and anti-woman? Does that complicate the issue? I'm just raising it and thinking out loud and maybe being stupid," which he said by way of something of a get out, I think, at the end there.
Yeah, I think he broadly was accurate in saying that at the end. he was thinking out loud, and he was being a bit of an idiot. But we should be allowed to think out loud and be bits of idiots, because I think it was quite... I think the rebuttal could have been better on the show. But you have basically seen me walk into a trap where Jimmy has presented me with a, you can talk about Drag Race again. And actually, it's just a chance for Jimmy to talk about Islam.
I think it's
which fair. I have fallen into many a time.
It's a sort of huddy trap for specifically for Jazza, I think it's fair to say. But I'm probably going to be, you know, slightly more sympathetic to what Jeff Goldblum said than Jazza has just been there. But shall we go to the begging for money section and then on to the main podcast?
Yeah, it's going to be exhausting, isn't it?
You're already exhausting.
Love you too.
If you like what we do at the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. It's a pretty conventional Patreon account, and I'm fairly sure most of you know how that works. So if you're interested, head over there and do the business. A big thank you to our existing patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, David Warner, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Ollie McGregor.
So, Jimmy, what actually is Sage's role, and why should we be horrified about the fact that a senior political advisor to the Prime Minister is attending these meetings?
So Sage's role is officially to provide impartial scientific advice. It was set up before the coronavirus, and it has dealt with things other than the coronavirus, but in this narrow instance, its role is to provide impartial advice, particularly around the coronavirus and the sort of strategies the government could or could not be adopting in order to tackle it. The problem with that, at least according to The Guardian in its news report, is that by having a political advisor sit in and participate in the meeting, it makes that process not so impartial, basically. It slants it and biases it. And some people have sort of bolstered this by this general criticism by saying that Dominic Cummings has a slightly questionable record when it comes to matters of science. He's clearly very interested in it, but a lot of people have said on reading his extensive rambling blogs,
that they're so long I can't get through them. Like if you are being framed as kind of like one of the great political minds of a generation or whatever, at least like provide some bite-sized versions of your thoughts. That would be better.
Well, I think he's in need of an editor, although maybe I would say that as an editor. but basically, on these long rambling blogs, a lot of people say that he misunderstands or misuses scientific facts towards his own ends, which I guess is kind of the accusation that's being levelled here.
I mean, it's confirmation bias. It's almost literally the job of politicians to take scientific studies and spin them or present them in ways that are convenient for their own means. Like, they work backwards rather than there is kind of like the fetishization for the possibility of there being evidence-based policy making, which was a phrase that was used in the Blair era.
Still is used, actually, all
the time. Yeah, but isn't so much by those who actually wield power. But actually, when you get politicians in power, they almost always work backwards. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I think it's this is the more general criticism I have really of there's no neat name, I think, for these sort of people, but there's certain people who are sympathetic to the idea of technocracy, which is government by experts, and sort of like it's sort of summed up in this phrase, oh, we're just following the science, as if like science can actually provide you with neat answers and you don't have to make value judgments and about, you know, given trade-offs with given policies. So I suppose I'm a little bit skeptical about whether Cummings' involvement is a problem in this committee, because, you know, imagine if he wasn't in on this committee, or this group, I should say, he would actually just be giving his input further down the line. And, you know, if you believe what people, what his harshest critics say about him, that he's basically the puppet master over Boris Johnson, it probably doesn't really matter at what stage of the process he's involved in, I don't think.
Yeah, I there's kind of this fetishization of science that I kind of resent as well, because science is not unbridled fact. That's not what science is. Science is the admitting of not knowing things and then looking for stuff. Actually, Brian Cox was very good at articulating this on this morning's Andrew Marr show.
Wow.
The idea that you follow the science and the science tells you the facts misinterprets completely what actual, especially in a new field and a one of the fuzzier, well, it's not really a fuzzy science, but in a brand new field like trying to figure out the best way of being able to deal with a pandemic like the coronavirus, there are going to be differing opinions and there are going to be different biases from the scientists who are performing the science. We saw that in the piece last week that we did on last week's episode 154. Listener, please do go back and check it out. When we talked about the Swedish ex-medical officer being interviewed on Unheard, like there were certain biases in the way that he had approached some of his data collection and some of his decision making that he had made around dealing with COVID-19. And so anybody who pretends that every single scientist, especially ones that work with and alongside politicians, are these archangels of impartiality and should be protected at all costs, needs to get a reality check and read books.
Well, there was that Reuters report which suggested, I know I referenced this in the last episode, but it said that when, I think it was Sage and NerveTag were discussing how to approach the COVID-19, they felt that a lockdown would not be politically acceptable, which has proved wrong. So that shows their fallibility in that sense.
Now we can't get enough of a lockdown. Oh my God, no, keep me in my house longer.
I'm not sure that's quite the attitude, but as you said, the polling does suggest that people are pretty supportive of it, at least for the time being in the UK. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is ultimately, whether you choose to lock down or not, is a political judgment. There are costs associated with enforcing a lockdown, which are largely kind of economic, I would say, in terms of people's day-to-day freedoms. And there are costs of not having a lockdown, which would probably be many more people dying because of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if, like, you know, I mean, it sounds, this is something that the Swedish guy kind of went into, but... You know, it's not necessarily obvious that the only solution to that is to have a lockdown, because, you know, people dying is obviously serious, but there are serious costs associated with the other side, albeit they might be a bit more intangible and a bit, you know, more dispersed, I guess you could say. I mean, you said before we started recording this, Jazz, that you're not the biggest fan of Dominic Cummings, but you don't seem particularly bothered that he's sat in on this committee.
Yeah, I am kind of, like, the way that this was framed by the Guardian, so attendees of Sage meeting worried by presence of Cummings. So they found two people who were in this meeting to give them anonymous quotes about how they don't like that this particular guy is in the Sage meeting. It makes sense that a political advisor, somebody with as much power in the government, is at that kind of a meeting. And actually The Times, just did a load, was very critical of high ups in the UK government not attending very serious meetings. And I don't think that you can have it both ways. I am not a fan of Cummings or his politics or his demeanour or his...
demeanour is just a fancy way of saying dress sense.
His dress sense or his face, frankly. I would downvote all of those things, but he is in the position that he is in and therefore should probably be attending the things that are relevant to his job. Of this is probably one of them. I begrudgingly have decided that he should be attending the Sage meetings. Thank you. I will be taking no more questions on this matter.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, like a White House correspondent, I think I'm going to try and ask you another question anyway. when you say you're not a fan of Cummings' politics, there's obviously the Brexit thing, but is there like a wider philosophy of Cummings that you don't like?
The ability to sideline the press so much, actually. And I think we're going to talk about this more in the Trump section that we have coming up next. But the way that the government sidelined really important media institutions of and kind of like media actions and set pieces of the way our democracy works and the way that politicians interact with democracy, I find really worrying. It isn't quite going along the same, like to the same extreme level as fake news, but telling ministers of the government that they aren't allowed to go on, for example, the Today programme, encouraging the Prime Minister to not partake in any debates in the run-up to elections. I think that all of those, that seeing the media as only an entity that is able, that should work for you and should allow you to kind of like sit down and then parrot off the government line, I think is really damaging. That's probably one of the major things in terms of how he has worked since becoming Johnson's political advisor that I am most worried by, because it is so much more subtle than just shouting fake news. It is kind of like planting the seeds of distrust and lack of accessibility to those in power for our mainstream media.
It's funny you mentioned that, actually. Did you see this polling that came out that suggested that the likes of Robert Peston, the ITV political reporter, is the wrong word, broadcaster,
He's the political editor.
Is he political editor? I thought he might be. People like Robert Peston, broadcasters and broadsheet journalists in general, are actually less trusted than politicians at the moment in relation to the COVID-19 crisis.
Mm-hmm. That to me makes sense. Because actually, it's the most trusted are healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
If you look at kind of like the whole thing. That doesn't surprise me at all.
But why are journalists? I mean, it should be said, just for context, that trust in journalists is generally pretty low and has been for quite a long time in the UK. But
but if we are going to see any evidence that makes us distrust those who are in power, then it is journalists who are going to be the ones, or whistleblowers, with the help of journalists, who are the ones that are going to be able to shed light on that. That doesn't really happen any other way. And so you, like, the people may distrust the journalists, but it kind of isn't necessarily a journalist's job to improve their poll numbers. That is a politician's job. But it is the job of the journalist to ensure that the public are made aware of as many of the facts about those who are wielding power as possible. If that makes sense?
I guess so, but the trouble is that if you don't trust journalists, then you're not necessarily going to trust the facts, the alleged facts that they're putting in front of you about politicians, for instance.
Mm-hmm. But I think that you can... I think that there's maybe a mismatch. I think that there's a mismatch between trusting journalists and listening and believing journalism. I think that you can distrust the profession of journalism and individual journalists, but then you can still be presented kind of like facts and make your own minds up about those kinds of things. I think that sometimes journalists don't help themselves in the way that I think some of our most outstanding traditional media institutions like the Times and the Guardian, even the BBC to a certain extent, I don't think they necessarily help themselves with the sensationalization of a lot of the way that they cover stories. But
I think it's difficult because to have like the ideal thing for a journalist to have is a fresh angle on something, and creating fresh angles is not necessarily the same thing as, you know, creating, as publishing articles about the most pertinent information or just following a story kind of where it naturally goes, mm-hmm. I guess you mm-hmm. could say. It's always the desire to get something new, as it, you know, it is called the news for a reason. I think it's slightly difficult in that sense.
What is it that you say that you kind of like have less of a problem with Dominic Cummings as an individual? What is it beyond Brexit that you perhaps maybe admire is a strong word, but what tickles your pickle about him?
I think he is, I mean, this sort of sounds slightly contradictory because he's best known effectively for winning elections, because he won the referendum. I think it's kind of taken as given that without him, Remain would have won the referendum.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that.
Even he in some of his blog posts actually argues about that. It's not certain, but I think it's quite likely. And kind of, I guess, ditto to some degree Boris Johnson's election as well, although you'd have to put down a significant chunk of that just to Boris Johnson's personal appeal. But he, you know, Cummings... Mm-hmm. Clearly is talented in that sense. All that said, he isn't a guy who seems to care whether he's liked or not, which I think counterintuitively is quite a likable characteristic, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's, well, I guess this is something that I find appealing about him, is that he is somebody that's willing to pursue unpopular conclusions about things, which I think is quite a good characteristic. So those are the things that I like about him. But I do recognise all your criticisms about his handling of the media is not good in some instances. There's the whole £350 million on the side of a coach thing, which I think he's justifiably criticised for. I just don't see him as like this satanic figure, and although you've kind of quibbled whether he is depicted that way, some people just see him as like the Antichrist almost.
Well, because do you know why it is? It's because his name gets clicks.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I excuse me.
If you are able to frame a story around Dominic Cummings, who's coming to eat all of your children, then you've got advertising to sell, haven't you?
I suppose there is that element of him, but the people I know who dislike Dominic Cummings, it's not a mild dislike. They think he is like a terrible person, and I just don't see any evidence that that is the case. I think he's, you know, aside from the things I've listed, he's actually a pretty normal person, really.
Yeah, most people aren't terrible people.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing, and I suppose it does kind of feed into that thing of. And I mostly see this on the progressive side of things rather than the right-wing side of things, but some progressives find it very easy to, like, demonise their opponents and, you know, describe them as evil or cunts or, you know, whatever else. And I think he's kind of fallen victim to that slightly. I think if he was doing roughly similar things but on the left-wing side of things, he would not be quite as demonised in that particular way. Mm. Although there are counter-examples. I mean, you know, Alistair Campbell is... he's actually demonised more by the left than the right, I think, but he'd be, I guess...
Interesting. Yeah, I was actually thinking that Dominic Cummings is basically a Brexit Alistair Campbell.
They have quite similar jobs, I think. I think... Alistair Campbell was like head of strategy or something.
Something along those lines. It was like a wonderfully vague job title.
Yeah. There are things I like about Cummings in summary, but I mostly just think that the way that he's depicted is kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And this article is one of the ways in which I think, mm-hmm. you know, he is depicted ridiculously.
Yeah.
Speaking of ridiculous things, Jazz, we should probably move on to Donald Trump. And the press conferences that are no longer.
Donald Trump suggested that you could bathe a body in light and it would be cured, possibly, of coronavirus. And then sarcastically said that maybe you could inject some cleaning liquid into someone and that would cleans a surface. Maybe it could clean the inside because it does a real number on the lungs. And I'm a man with a really, really big, you know. And then the media ran and made the whole thing blew it out of proportion. The idiot media thought that my sarcasm, sorry, that his sarcasm was was genuine. Kind of like things that they fell for it. Idiots. And so now he's not going to give them the pleasure of taking part in the daily press conferences anymore.
I mean, my immediate reaction to all this is I'm actually kind of skeptical about the value of those press conferences anyway.
Yeah, it was just he was just having a nice time having a go at a load of politicians saying that they were fake news. And
you mean journalists?
You were the journalists who are in the room with him and definitely are not 2 meters away from each other, by the way. Like, shocker. The next seat across is not actual social distancing. But anyway. He has been really enjoying sparring with these journalists and just basically telling them to shut up. It hasn't been particularly graceful debate, but now he isn't having a nice time because he suggested that people should inject themselves with... He didn't suggest that. He suggested that injecting patients with cleaning liquid could possibly help kill the virus.
I mean, to be fair, it's possible that's true.
Because
it
would kill the virus, but it would also kill the person.
Yeah, I mean, that's all he was saying, right?
It's a small technicality.
All he was saying. If you're able to kill the virus, then maybe Donald Trump should, open that nuclear football and start pressing some buttons. That would probably halt the virus in its tracks pretty quickly.
Don't, it will happen. And he'll win in November, and it's all going to go really badly.
I suppose that is something that I don't think many people have discussed yet, just because, I guess because it's a little bit a ways ahead, but do you think the presidential election's still going to happen at this rate?
They've never missed one in however many hundreds of years they've had them. Never missed one, never postponed them. I have a feeling that it will go ahead, but with many people not being able to vote, because there seems to be in Congress in the Senate, there is a lot of there's pushback against having all of the measures in place for it to be a postal election, which would be a possible way of being able to bypass the problems of social distancing coronavirus. It would also it's also often decided because the US is 50 states, it's decided at the state level, and actually the states decide how many delegates with the Electoral College, how many delegates they kind of put forward, essentially. And so very often it's a state decision rather than a
federal decision.
Rather than a federal decision, yeah. But who knows, man? It's not going to be normal because they're not going to have social distancing lifted across the board by November.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been thinking, is that it sort of seems increasingly likely that I'm guessing we won't, like in the UK, we won't be in full lockdown in November, but, it seems unlikely that all of the restrictions will have lifted at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, the US is a little bit behind us in terms of its the virus's progress, so there's that element of it. But I don't know. I mean, there are various ways around it, but then you kind of think, like, in the UK, we were supposed to have... local elections and London mayoral elections, among other things, in May, and they decided to postpone those for a year.
Yeah,
I suppose that's actually one of the glories of Britain's democracy, is there's a certain level of flexibility with those kind of things, whereas in America everything's written down, and well, most things are written down, and if you try and actually change anything, someone will just start suing you.
So apparently, the date of the election is quite easy to move, but the date the date of the election isn't set in stone, or is a lot easier to move than the inauguration is the hardest thing to move. Like, because that, I think, is the thing that's in the Constitution. I don't think the date of the election is necessarily in the Constitution. Correct me if I'm wrong. But the inauguration is the hardest one to move, because I think it says it's like the X week in January after the election, blah, 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 blah. Can you imagine if we were having an election during this time? It'd be fucking nuts.
Well, in theory, in the UK, you could... you know, the House of Commons could vote to delay the election by, you know, even if we were up against the five-year limit, they could vote to delay the election through some legislation.
Which they probably would, to be fair.
Yeah, but and then the Lords could, you know, so long as the Lords were actually happy to sign off on that, then it would go ahead. That does seem an advantage. But, yeah, I mean, to get back to this thing around Trump and the press conferences, it kind of I only loosely follow the comings and goings of Donald Trump. I think you're closer to it than I am. But other than just generating like outrage stories about, you know, Trump calling it the coronavirus the Chinese virus or whatever, it doesn't seem to shed an awful lot of useful information, I think, about very much. I mean, maybe do you think I'm wrong about that?
No, it's not. I think it's next to impossible to shed any light, even light that could kill the coronavirus, on a press conference with Trump. It's a spectacle.
Yeah,
it's kind of. And actually, even when you're looking at the things that he said that were so controversial, it can be very, very difficult to understand what he's saying. It's not what he says. What comes out of his mouth isn't even a train of thought. It's like a train of half-thought thoughts.
Yeah, he continually does that thing where he starts one sentence and then switches to another halfway through and ends on a third or maybe even a fourth.
So here's an example. I would like you to speak to the medical doctors to see if there's any way that you can apply light and heat to cure. You know, if you could. And maybe you can. Maybe you can't. Again, I say maybe you can. Maybe you can't. I'm not a doctor, but I'm like a person that has a good you-know-what. Deborah, have you ever heard of that? The heat and the light, relative to certain viruses. But yes, relative to this virus?
It sounds
What does he mean? What does he actually...
me on a podcast where I decide halfway through a sentence that I don't agree with what I'm about to say. Just try to pivot away desperately. And then end with a disclaimer. You know, I'm not a doctor.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I do really worry about... him.
I've kind of oscillated on the question of whether he is a genuine idiot or whether it's contrived. I still think it is somewhat contrived, but I also think he is a genuine fuckwit in certain places. He's not a man who's ever been rebuffed, I think, on account of his lack of talent for things. He's sort of the ultimate private schoolboy in that sense.
Oh my god, yeah. Oh my god, that's the similarity between him. Because I actually think that it's inaccurate to call Boris Johnson a Donald Trump of the UK. But that is
I think that's one similarity, I think, maybe.
Yeah, that runs through them like a stick of rock. The private schoolboy, you've never been told you're wrong, you've been told you can do anything.
Yeah, things. Yeah.
We should both probably disclaim that we're both private schoolboys, so we know what it's like.
We do
that's
know.
That's why we have a podcast.
I think we've probably failed slightly more than Boris Johnson, which is why neither you nor me are king of the UK yet.
Yeah, I don't want that. I want to make that really, really clear.
Obviously, you kind of brought this up earlier, but Britain has been having its own regular press conferences with the Prime Minister, which isn't something that normally happens in the normal turn of events. Mm-hmm. You know, bear in mind that Trump's press conferences aren't exactly conventional, but do you think once the coronavirus crisis is over, is that something that you'd actually like to see more of, where journalists are given the opportunity to quiz the Prime Minister?
I also would question how much light there is in those meetings, especially at the moment. There is, I mean, Carol Cadwalder, I very rarely have a lot of time for, but I think she did have a point when I think a couple of weeks ago she tweeted that there was just no real ability for there to be rebuttal in real time when you have journalists calling in from their rooms with like a banner of that they've been given by their broadcaster to have right, up in the background. Yeah. And like, there's that dynamic doesn't really allow for there to be a very much probing. It allows for there to be a, here's my set response. Now you can come back on that, and here's another set response. And it was similar stuff to what we saw with like the digitization of Parliament as well, I think, which yeah. has similar problems of there not being able to be a real actual dynamic conversation.
I think that problem would be alleviated, you know, once the restrictions on the lockdown restrictions lift, though, if the journalists were in the same room as the Prime Minister and could ask questions more, you know, in a more direct conference style. I think that wouldn't be such an issue.
Yeah, perhaps.
I would also say, like, I do, obviously politicians very rarely give a straight answer, but I feel that, you know, British politicians, unlike Trump, at least try and vaguely give the impression they've answered the question, at least.
Yeah, whereas he has absolutely no interest whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what those kinds of regular press conferences would add to kind of like our political conversation in the UK. Those conversations happen in other ways here.
Well, there has been some debate around whether the
Blair used to do them.
Not regularly, I don't think.
There were regular press briefings, I think, actually, from Alistair Darling.
Alistair Campbell, you mean?
Alistair Campbell, yeah, sorry. Not Alistair Darling.
Well, like, although he was also around, you know. Those are the lobby briefings. So, and I think that the lobby briefings, the way they're supposed to work is that journalists go in and speak to a government spokesman and they can, you know, go and write stories and off the basis of that. But I think there's an argument for having, you know, for televising those briefings in the same way that, you know, the White House spokesman used to give televised briefings to, you know, the equivalent in the US. I think that kind of does make sense to me. It certainly seems a slightly fairer way of doing things than having closed briefings, I think. Partly because it, you know, it gives the... It turns that into an opportunity for the government to actually kind of agree, align with the journalists to some degree, you know, whereas if it's all televised, then you can see what they actually said. And it's none of it's like, you know, shrouded in secrecy or the relative secrecy of a non-televised briefing.
What do you... I know that you, like, this is my wheelhouse, really, but I'm curious, do you think that there's any... chance of Trump still winning, because my gut still says that he could win this year in November if there is still an election.
I don't know if I actually did run the numbers on this, but I think offhand that most sitting presidents that go for a second term win.
Correct.
I think on just on the basis of that rule of thumb, he's more likely to win than not.
However, he's going to be either in or coming out of a
recession.
The worst recession that we've seen since the Great Depression.
They're going to blame him for that? I mean, it's one thing to blame a sitting president for the economy going badly during the normal course of things, but
I think he's very good at creating different narratives in different parts of the country. I think we saw that in 2016 when he beat Clinton, where he was able to activate the feelings of a really particular part of the country or people from particular parts of the country. And you can see it with the way that he's been targeting governors, because actually it's governors of states rather than the federal president who is able to kind of like restrict and lift and change lockdown restrictions at a local level. And he's been very much targeting states that he won in 2016, like Michigan. He's been targeting them with kind of like tweets saying, liberate Michigan, liberate X, Y, Z, all of them kind of battleground states of his. Whether or not this will work will depend on how the actual voters who are going to end up voting, how they feel about the coronavirus. The more people die, the more they're going to find this gung-ho attitude towards the virus distasteful.
I mean, Trump is pretty distasteful anyway, so I'm not sure that's a big barrier for a lot of Trump voters.
I mean, since Biden became the presumptive nominee, and they've been doing polling, he is constantly ahead of Trump in national polls. There isn't a single one in the last couple of weeks that he hasn't led Trump on by between kind of like 4 and 14 points.
Are those similar margins to how Clinton was leading Trump throughout the campaign?
I would not be able to tell you. I cannot remember. I know that she ended up on 2/3
right.
chance. What's the word? What's the like 66% chance of being president? And I don't think 538, who are my source of truth here,
right?
I don't think that they are presenting data in that way anymore, because of the confusion that it caused in 2016.
Yeah, I guess it's probably too early to say. But I think these are obviously kind of exceptional times. I mean, actually exceptional times. But that said, I think a lot of the rules of thumb around presidential elections, such as does a sitting president usually win a second term, I think they're probably better metrics, more trustworthy metrics to go by, than really fixating on the fact that there is a, you know, there's a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd imagine a lot of those do sit in Trump's favor. There is the economy thing, which I think, you know, that's obviously a fairly significant blow for him, and it's a pretty good rule of thumb that if the economy is going badly, then the incumbent is going to suffer for it. I'd have to look into it a bit more, I think, but I think probably the signs point both ways at this stage.
Great. Well, that's why you listen to this podcast, for that in-depth political analysis and know-how.
Well, people that say they know are lying to you. So
it's better to
plead ignorance, I think.
Yeah.
Although we'll have to wait for Jazz's patented gut instinct. When that finally reveals itself to us, then we'll know who's
going. Oh, no, but it's not been very good recently, has it?
I think I gave a better prediction than you for the December 2019 election. I think mine was.
Yeah, I think I predicted Conservatives' largest party, but no majority.
Oh, yeah.
Again, I think was my prediction, and I was wrong.
It's tough when you're wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've moved on.
Shall we pivot to our final topic, discussing RuPaul?
Yes, Jimmy, explain yourself. You are not a fan of Drag Race. How did you end up coming across the fact that Jeff Goldblum said some asked some oddly worded questions about Islam on my favourite reality TV show?
My girlfriend watches RuPaul's Drag Race, and I'm often in the same room.
Oh, so likely story. Yeah.
I don't want to get bogged down in this argument, but I will say this anyway, even though it might provoke you. I think it's kind of an obnoxious show. I think like the people in it are fairly unlikable most of the time.
You think that drag queens are obnoxious? Interesting analysis there, Jimmy. Interesting.
I don't know. I find them annoying. I think the contestants. I'm not saying all drag queens are annoying, but all of their like weird like pretend beefs with one another, and them all acting as though they're like, you know, sassy black women from the south. I'm not really sure. I don't know. It doesn't really do it for me.
You don't understand what direction that culture came from, did you?
No, never mind.
We'll have a conversation about it off podcast.
I'm not disparaging their they can do that. I'm not criticizing it from like an intersectional point of view or whatever. I just think it's annoying. It's just there's a different, it's not contingent on its origin story, really.
Mm-hmm. Can you remind us just what Jeff Goldblum said? I'll let you bring that up and I'll explain kind of like the set of the actual episode. So they've just had to do a false presidential debate, where each of them have to stand on a podium and basically be funny. They're not actually running for president, for goodness sake, but it's like a nice little fun take.
Some of that was legitimately funny. I'll give them that.
How generous of you. Thank you. I'm sure that they were there gunning for your approval. So they then have to walk the runway in a patriotic dress. So it awkwardly ends up that the bottom two is somebody who decided to pay homage to black rights and the Black Panther movement with the costume that they were wearing. And the other person who was in the bottom that week and then therefore has to lip sync for their life was a Canadian Iranian American wearing a Star Spangled Banner hijab, essentially. And that prompted this question from Jeff Goldblum, the actor from Jurassic Park and Fly fame. What did he say, Jimmy?
He said, is there something in this religion, Islam, that is anti-homosexuality and anti-woman? Does that complicate the issue? I'm just raising it and thinking out loud and maybe being stupid. Mm-hmm. Before we turn to what he said, why is Jeff Goldblum appearing on RuPaul's Drag Race? What's the
Because it turns out, Jimmy, despite the fact that you don't fall into one of these brackets, straight people can like drag too.
So he's appearing as a fan, is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, they have. Actually, I would argue. I assume that most of the guest judges that they have are like straight fans of the show now. It's a very big thing in Hollywood, especially. And they are very. Yeah, they get pretty big stars on that show as guest judges now.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit incongruous, I think. You sort of expect like some sort of experts in drag to be judging that kind of thing.
Well, that's meant to be Michelle Visage and RuPaul,
right?
As the host, yeah.
So anyway, so what I think Goldblum was saying is that so before like Jackie Cox, like before he said this, Jackie Cox I think said something about how. You know, what her look was mm-hmm. basically celebrating her heritage, her Iranian heritage, and she said something about
she'd had a hard time with the ban, what is often called the Muslim ban, but the ban on people being able to come to the United States from Muslim majority countries, yeah, including yeah. Iran. It stopped his auntie from being able to come to the United States to care for Jackie Cox's grandmother. Specific story that was told.
So Goldblum then said, like, you know. What do you think he was trying to say with his comment?
I think he was his ignorance was exposed, and I think that he I don't think he's a bad person. I think he was trying to ask, isn't it a bit weird that you're proud of being a Muslim and also being gay?
Yeah.
I think that's basically what he was saying. Yeah. But he was he was having that thought as he said it out loud, and it wasn't posed very elegantly.
To be fair to him, I think he said it very gingerly, and he was clearly not trying to be deliberately provocative.
I 100% agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you.
He wasn't trying to be offensive, I don't think.
No, I agree. But he was definitely very clumsy about it. Which is why
a nice way to ask that question, to be honest. I think it's, and I think it is a fair question.
I think the desire to not the desire to not offend made it come across as even more weird and inappropriate. Maybe if there were a more direct.
Well, could have said, like, isn't it strange that you're celebrating Islamic dress when Islam, by and large, is a homophobic religion?
Yeah, but Jimmy, this is the thing. What I would have loved the comeback to be would have been, well, we've had queens from religious backgrounds talking about God left, right and centre all the time, and that is very rarely something. I mean, I don't think it's ever really come up. Nobody said, how can you be a Christian and also be a drag queen?
I think that's also a fair question, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but it isn't asked in the same way. And I think maybe because it is a minority religion, I almost know this, it is a minority religion that kind of that doesn't get the that is presented as other, that isn't understood very well by the mainstream in America or across like a lot of the West, and so there isn't kind of like an understanding of how you can nuancedly be somebody who identifies as LGBTQ plus and also be proud of Muslim heritage, whereas because America is a majority Christian country, when there are Christian queens who talk about God and talk about their kind of like relationship with God and are also talk about it being a homophobic religion, right, and the homophobia that they have experienced. But there have been so many opportunities for that story to have been told that it's kind of like people are able to be more articulate about it, and people understand actually the ability for you to be able to be a queer person and also be a Christian. That conversation happens so little, and there's so little visibility of Muslim people, especially queer Muslim people, that people are just like have no idea what that, how you can even possibly be proud of being Muslim and also be LGBT. You must have had to have cut at all ties with that part of your identity. Whereas actually that isn't the experience for quite a lot of people who have Muslim backgrounds in the queer community. Like Jackie is only the second Muslim queen to be on the show in 12 seasons, plus some all-star seasons, which I don't really count, in like over 100 and something drag queens. There's only been this conversation really once, maybe twice, whereas it comes up a lot more with people from other religions.
Well, maybe if Jackie Cox had addressed the apparent contradiction up front, then Goldblum wouldn't have said anything. He'd have been like, oh, well, fair enough.
Yeah, but also she had just had a very emotional confessionary time in front of RuPaul and Jeff Goldblum, for fuck's sake. Like, yeah, I don't think you're necessarily there trying to give kind of like a lecture and be able to be thoughtful when you're about to have to lip sync to Katy Perry's Firework.
Well, I think the other thing is that, you know, I do take the point that Christianity does, has its own problems with homophobia, but I think it's fair to say the Christian world, by and large, is more tolerant of homosexuality than the Muslim world.
It depends. Just with any of the religions.
It depends, there but are part, I'm, saying, there are parts I'm saying of, by it, and large, if you look at Europe, South America, North America, even Australia, New Zealand as well, the countries that are majority Christian are more tolerant of homosexuals than, say, North Africa, Middle East, Southeast Asia as well.
That tends to be the case, but that does not mean that people are not able to accept queer people and also be Muslim.
Yeah, I'm just saying it is a more valid criticism to level against Islam, given the development of Christianity.
I'm not sure, just because it happens in more countries and is more widespread in Muslim countries, I don't think that means that it warrants more criticism. I think it warrants criticism wherever it is. Do you know what I mean? Like some of the
That is a bonkers statement.
No, but some
it's like saying, well,
Jimmy. So from my perspective, I have been more affected by homophobia in Christianity than I have by homophobia in Islam. And so for me, the homophobia in Christianity is so much more salient for me and so much more of my lived experience that, of course, I'm going to be more critical. It's also a religion that I understand a lot more. So I'm going to be really vocal about it because it is so much closer to me in my experience. What we should be doing is allowing, and hope, like, it's a lot scarier, I think, because sometimes the consequences can be worse for people from Muslim backgrounds. But we should be allowing for there to be more of these stories told of queer people from Muslim backgrounds, so that more people can see that it is possible for you to not have to resent your background and to leave your family and those kinds of things. Like, I don't think that it all has to be kind of digested in the round. Every person's experience is going to be different, but of course I am going to be very critical and possibly more critical of Christianity, because that is the experience that I have had. I've never been affected by, personally, like in terms of me as an individual, I've never been affected by homophobia in Islam. And so I think, why would I be pointing over there and saying that? Do you know what I mean?
I take your point, but I think if you believe in universal human rights, then, you know, it's fair game to criticize other cultures. I mean, I suppose it's fair game to criticize other cultures, even if you don't believe in I think there's the tenderness around this particular story is because progressives, on the one hand, feel very much that they need to reach out and include people from non-Western cultures. But also, you know, and that also makes them uncomfortable about criticizing elements of those cultures, even if there are very noxious elements within those cultures.
Yeah, but Jimmy, I ain't going to be the person to make that change. It needs to happen with people that they aren't going to see as completely other. Like, if I try to go over to a Muslim, one of the Muslim mums in... one of the mums who was protesting outside of the schools in Birmingham about LGBTQ plus inclusive sex ed, sex and relationship education. I'm not going to be the one to carry that message for her. I'm not a woman. I'm not from a minority background when it comes to my race, and I'm not straight, and I don't have kids, and I'm not a mother. Like, I'm not going to be the person to be able to change that. I'm not the vessel for that change, I don't think. Other people from within that community probably are.
Yeah, I see that totally as a point of, like, wider strategy. But you were very critical of Jeff Goldblum, and I actually don't really think that you disagree with what he...
Do you think I was critical of him? I thought he was a bumbling fool.
Well, bumbling fool is quite critical, I would say. I think, you know, I don't think you really disagree with what he said in substance. I just think that you kind of object to the fact that he said it, given that he's a straight white Hollywood actor and not a, you know, a queer Muslim.
No. Because what he exposed there was a lack of understanding that you can be queer and Muslim. Like, those two identities can exist together.
There is a pretty deep tension between the two of them, I think it's fair to say.
As with Christianity and being a Christian and queer.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
Like, they're probably reasonably similar experiences. I don't know. I'm not religious. I'm actually glad that he asked that question for us to be able to have these other conversations. I also wish that the show were better at being able to kind of, like, provide context. I don't think it was terrible at providing context, but we can always wish for things that we like to be better, right?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Cool.
I suppose so. Is there anything further you want to add?
No, you've got me riled up now. I'm gonna have to have a fucking bath with chamomile.
I was actually gonna joke about you having a bath, and then you just said it.
Wow, a great insight into your mind, Jimmy. Thank you.
I know you so well, Jazza. I know you like to have baths. have a cold bath and cool yourself off.
Oh, yeah.
Stupid or het up. where can people find you online if they want to tweet about you and offer you emotional support in these trying times?
At Jazza John across all social media. Thank you.
Thank you. You can find me at JDE Nichols only on Twitter, which I probably should give up at some point, but I haven't done yet. So... No progress has been made. I think we can wrap it up there.
Great.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, you fucked me off.